This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
43 years ago this month, President Richard Nixon signed the National Cancer Act of 1971, effectively starting the so-called War on Cancer. The law greatly increased the amount of money earmarked for cancer research and scientific study. So, how's that war going?
Mortality in the United States has gone down by 22% since 1990.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation with the Chief Science Officer of the American Cancer Society about the past, present, and future of cancer research. We'll also visit a high school in Niagara Falls that's devoting a lot of time and money into STEM education. And we'll spend an academic minute explaining the physics of a whirling dervish. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Otis Brawley loves to talk about making people healthy. Brawley is a professor of hematology, oncology, medicine, and epidemiology at Emory University. He is also the chief medical and scientific officer and executive vice president of the American Cancer Society. A couple of years ago, he wrote a book called How We Do Harm: A Doctor Breaks Ranks About Being Sick in America, which takes the U.S. healthcare system to task over being profit, not patient-driven. We got a chance to sit down with Dr. Brawley at a speaking engagement recently and asked, with all the advances in research over the years, shouldn't we be farther along in the fight against cancer?
Well, cancer is an incredibly complicated disease. When I started, I thought of cancer as 200 different diseases. Now, when I look at breast cancer, I think of breast cancer as at least 18 different diseases, probably even more. That's the beginning of the answer. We are making some inroads. Mortality in the United States has gone down by 22% since 1990. For breast cancer, it's gone down by 35%. Oh, a 60-year-old woman today, her risk of dying from breast cancer is two-thirds the risk that it was in 1990. So we are making some progress. I would also say we're making progress in colon cancer, in lung cancer. There's still a lot to do. You know, we still are going to have close to 600,000 Americans die from the disease this year. But if we hadn't made the progress that we've made up to this date, it would probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of 900,000 dying.
What are some of the advances in research that are responsible for those improvements?
Some of the advances are treatment, for example, in breast cancer. Our ability to treat breast cancer, especially estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, has improved dramatically. Actually, our improvements in treatment of breast cancer account for more of the decline in breast cancer mortality rate than to screening. Many people think screening is much better, but it's actually treatment that has caused the majority of the decline in mortality. Same is true in colorectal cancer. Although screening for colorectal cancer has given us about half of the decline there. We're understanding what's going on in the cancerous cell today in ways that we never dreamed of 25 years ago. And that's giving us what I call druggable targets. A druggable target means something that I know if I can affect with a drug, I can actually help the patient by stopping the growth of the cancer.
And what's behind these advances in medicine? Is it the continued research? Is it so-called big data? What's driving this?
Well, genomics is a huge improvement, and that is the understanding that it's not just one gene. It may be as many as 20 different genes and how those genes interact. Genomics has also given us many of these targets that are druggable, meaning things that we can interfere with to stop a cancer from growing. The other important thing that has come about is our ability to understand that there is not just one breast cancer, there may be 18 or more types of breast cancer, and the treatment for each breast cancer is going to be slightly different drugs. Some of the receptors that we have developed in druggable targets, the one that's most exciting is a drug called Gleevec, which targets some genetics within chronic myelogenous leukemia. And that's actually taken chronic myelogenous leukemia, which used to kill people in 3 to 5 years, to being a disease where some people are going to live with it chronically for the rest of their lives, for 20 or 30 years, just by taking a couple of pills every day. Now, of course, we've seen that Gleevec is also effective in certain types of sarcomas called gastrointestinal stromal tumors. So we're starting to see that these genetic targets exist in a number of different cancers, and one drug for one disease may be quite useful in another disease.
Where would you say we're falling behind and advances are coming slowly?
We still need to do a lot of basic research, and we still need to find more targets, and we need to find more drugs for those targets, that on one hand. The other thing we need to realize in the United States is we have a large number of people who are not benefiting from the science that we already have. Some of the studies that we do at the American Cancer Society, for example, show that in Atlanta, 7% of black women and 2 to 3% of white women who have localized early detected breast cancer, which is curable, get no treatment within the first year. Now, they got the early detection, and they had enough access to care that a pathologist read a biopsy as this is cancer, but they get no treatment within the first year. One of the greatest problems, and this is real tragedy, especially in the United States, is we have made scientific advances, and there's a significant proportion of Americans who do not get to share in those scientific advances.
You're on record as being very critical of the American healthcare system, and your book, How We Do Harm, pretty much takes no prisoners in criticizing how patients are treated in the U.S. Is that what you're talking about here? How are Americans not getting the full benefits of American medicine?
We in American medicine are failing the patients in a number of ways. I noted that we have had a greater than 20% decline in cancer death rates since 1990. The sad fact is the United States was the 31st country to have a 20% decline in cancer mortality. And actually, there's the argument that we've advanced the science in this country, and a number of other countries in Europe and elsewhere have been able to apply our advances better than we have. We pay for all the research, and then they take the results of it and apply it to their populations better than ours. The U.S. medical system has been affected by a number of very negative things, one of them being greed and the desire to make money, one of them being people who need health care, human beings who need health care not being able to access it. There are a number of issues that need to be tackled. I'm a little bit optimistic about medicine. You know, as I have traveled the country over the last 10 to 15 years, I find the younger doctors and the younger nurses are much more understanding of the need to practice what we call evidence-based medicine, and that is look at what the science says and then apply the science, not look at what a doctor thinks and apply what that doctor thinks.
Well, Dr. Brawley, let's look ahead. What are the promising avenues of research that'll give us the best chances of beating cancer?
By far, in my mind, the most promising avenue, there are two, I would say. One is genomics, which is helping us to understand and redefine cancer. And the other is understanding what we need to do to prevent cancer. When I say genomics to help us understand and redefine cancer, you know, cancer was defined by German pathologists in the mid-1850s. And we're now starting to find, with all of our new technologies, x-ray, ultrasound, MRI, even biopsy technology, stereotactic biopsy technologies, we're now starting to find that some of the 5-millimeter tumors in a woman's breast or small tumors in a man's prostate are not genomically programmed to grow, spread, and kill the patient. And we're actually finding that there are some breast cancers that look like cancer under the microscope, but are not going to behave the way we typically think of cancers as something that's going to grow, spread, and kill. And we're starting to be able to categorize these tumors, and we're starting to be able to say, Mrs. Jones, you have breast cancer, but it seems that it's breast cancer light. It's a benignish sort of thing that's not going to harm you. We're going to treat it, but we're not going to treat it very aggressively. And we say, Mrs. Johnson, you have the kind of breast cancer that's very aggressive and kills, so we're going to treat your cancer incredibly aggressively. In the case of prostate cancer, we're actually able to now determine that somewhere between 40 and 60% of the localized prostate cancers, the worst thing we can do for the poor guy is tell him that's what he has, because it was never going to bother him, and now we're going to bother him by labeling him a cancer patient and by treating it. We're getting better in being able to figure out what cancers need to be treated for prostate cancer and what cancers need to be watched. And so we're changing the name of cancer. When it comes to prevention, we're starting to realize it's not just tobacco, but we need to worry about calories. The combination of high caloric intake, lack of physical activity, and obesity, it's a three-legged stool, is going to become the leading cause of cancer over the next 10 to 20 years. It's going to surpass tobacco. And so we need to look at obesity, we need to look at diet, we need to try to increase the amount of protein in our diet, increase the amount of fruits and vegetables in our diet, get away from these calorie-dense foods that we've been consuming. And you know, in the United States, our consumption of calories has increased dramatically over the last 40 years. We've got to stop doing that. By the way, our caloric intake is far greater than the caloric intake of the number two country in the world for obesity, which is England. 20% of adults in England are obese. 35% or more of adults in the United States are obese.
And there we go right back to lifestyle choices, diet and exercise. What's the ballpark guess, and with you it's a pretty educated guess, about how many cancers could be prevented if we just lived a healthier life?
We think about 50 to 60%. It's not just my number. I think this is a number that most epidemiologists would agree upon. About 50 to 60% of the cancers in the United States are due to bad health habits. Diet, lack of exercise, obesity, smoking. And that is to say, about half of all cancers are preventable if we just simply did the right things. And it's difficult to do the right things, and especially when our society is actually helping us to not do the right things. You know, we move to suburbs where we don't have sidewalks, so we don't walk as much as we used to. If we live in urban areas, because of crime, we don't walk as much as we used to. We've got refrigerators now, so we can actually stock up on calorie-dense processed foods. So when we consume a meal, we actually consume more calories than we used to. There are numerous things. Now, we've made some inroads in smoking, but still 20% of Americans smoke. 1 in 5 Americans smoke. We know we can do better than that. If you go to California, it's 1 in 10 Americans smoke. By the way, if you go to West Virginia or Kentucky or Missouri, it's 1 in 3 Americans smoke.
Is this something that the family doctor should be spending more time on when they see their patients? I mean, every doctor in the world is going to tell a patient to stop smoking and be pretty adamant about it. Should they be more adamant about staying away from calories?
Well, I actually have worried that doctors don't have enough time to talk to their patients. I've also thought that these are messages that ought to be brought to the patient outside of the doctor-patient relationship. So education in schools. You know, we've had some problems in that some of our politicians have actually criticized Michelle Obama for encouraging kids to exercise and to eat fruits and vegetables. And unfortunately, that sort of criticism and shutting down programs like that is likely to be net harmful, not just to those kids as they grow into adulthood, but to the U.S. economy. Keep in mind, 19 cents out of every dollar spent in the United States right now is spent on healthcare. The number two country, by the way, is Switzerland and Norway. They're at about 11 cents out of every dollar.
Dr. Otis Brawley is a professor of hematology, oncology, medicine, and epidemiology at Emory University. He is also the chief medical and scientific officer and executive vice president of the American Cancer Society. Still to come, a high school in Western New York is putting a high value on STEM education. We'll visit next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Well, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1265. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The Niagara Falls City School District has made an impressive investment to implement STEM programs in every one of its schools. In this report from radio station WBFO's Focus on Education report, Eileen Buckley toured the Niagara Falls High School, where students were breaking in brand new STEM labs for learning.
Niagara Falls High School students were researching websites, trying to determine if information was credible. It may seem like a simple task, but this lesson involved plagiarism. They're learning that when writing scientific research papers, it's important to make sure they're not simply lifting material from websites without fact-checking and attribution.
This is very college level, so we are finding that they're listening, and I think a lot of this information is like very new to them.
Bana Chowdhury is the STEM bioscience lead instructor at the high school. This research class is one of the many science, technology, engineering, and math programs taught at the school.
We have, you know, purposefully and intentionally put these things into place because this is something that they're going to use to be able to do the work that we have set up.
As students conduct this coursework in the classroom setting, just a few feet away is one of the brand new stem cell labs created for actual research projects.
And we have four very exciting units that we have planned for this year. They are sustainability, cancer, and traumatic brain injuries, as well as the biosciences, where the students are going to learn about nutrition, they're going to learn about cardiology, and we have specifically selected topics that are very relevant to the kids' lives.
This gives a little more flexibility and gets them ready for the actual job.
Denise Karski is a co-instructor in biosciences. She's a math teacher and will work with students to integrate math into their science projects.
Get these kids ready for some of the things that they may use in an actual workplace, like, you know, using Excel spreadsheets, using, technology.
Karski admits Common Core is difficult for some inner city students, but STEM is helping them learn concepts.
You know, we're rising, to the occasion, and we're raising, the expectations, and hopefully they're gonna rise to them.
Here we are doing hands-on work, doing group work, learning how to work with other people, being able to solve tasks.
Sierra Spain is a junior at Niagara Falls High School.
Because not only is it beneficial, but I'm actually interested. Generally, when you take courses, they're not really things you'd like to take, and this is something I've always been interested in, such as science and math, and I think it is very beneficial to my learning.
I think the STEM class teaches kids a new way of learning. It's not like a regular class and out of book reading.
Michael Saunders is also a junior at the high school. He says STEM is making him think differently.
For example, if you're in your math class or a different science class, if you can't figure out how to do a problem, this helps you with your problem solving skills, which can help you in other courses.
I want to go into science and stuff.
Freshman Rochelle Hilton is excited and nervous to be at a new school, but she attended a STEM camp over the summer.
And I really liked it. We did different types of things. We made solar. We worked with like solar energy, and we made like ovens and stuff. And we burned things to see, like, we burned like cheese and different types of like food to see like the calories of things.
There is a newly constructed applied innovation lab at the high school focusing on engineering. Valerie Rotella-Zavuto is a science instructor for the lab. She says students have quickly engaged in the STEM program.
I think they struggle with relevance, just trying to, you know, figure out what we're learning in the classroom and how we can apply it to the real world. This class is designed to do just that. So how can we take the math, how can we take the science, and now how can we use it in the real world?
We're going to throw them right into the creation process where they're going to learn the math and they're going to learn the science, but they're going to learn it because they're applying it, not so much because we're teaching them a lesson on it.
Amy Kilmer is lead instructor teaching math.
Where do the students that you can see struggle the most when it comes to math?
I think kids struggle the most because they want to see the application of it. So they're reluctant to learn it in the beginning because they feel like, why do I have to learn it? Why do you have it in the curriculum? So if we have the opportunity to tell them this is where they're going to learn it, so let's learn it now, I think the reluctance to learn it would end because now they could see why they're learning it.
STEM construction continues at other Niagara Falls schools. City School Superintendent Cynthia Bianco says they're the only district in the state that's been dedicated to constructing STEM classrooms in all of its schools.
We're really getting into the 21st century. We look at technology as being a great leveler for our students because this is a pretty poor area, pretty poor city. So we try to level the playing field for our children by offering them the best that we can in education and technology in education. STEM classrooms complement that effort.
We try to think about what we would need for the future, what our students should be exposed to.
Lynn Tompkins is STEM coordinator for the district and also serves as house principal at the Niagara Falls High School.
We want to give them every opportunity that any other child would have. What's neat is we're on the front end of the curve here. Nobody else is really doing it like this. So our students have state-of-the-art from the start.
The Niagara Falls School District began STEM construction in 2012. It's a more than $66 million capital project called Inventing Tomorrow, and it's already inspiring students.
And that report came from Eileen Buckley from WBFO in Buffalo, New York. Ever thought about the physics involved in a whirling dervish? You will now. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Can decorative garments help inform our knowledge of physics? James Hanna, assistant professor of mechanics at Virginia Tech, is observing the complex rotations of whirling dervishes.
We're trying to understand the dynamics and mechanics of sheets and membranes, not skirts per se, but the work was inspired by the patterns that emerge on the skirts of whirling dervishes. These guys spin around and they generate this steadily rotating shape with several sharp peaks rather than something uniformly circular. We wondered what was behind these features and whether we could capture them with a simple model. The model we study is very basic. We ignore the effect of the air and even gravity. We assume that we have a uniform piece of material with no pre-existing pattern, and the only forces we consider are the tension in the material and the inertial forces that arise from its motion. With that, we come up with an equation which we can solve analytically. The result is a family of shapes that describe the possible rotating configurations of the sheet or skirt. What's interesting is that this minimal representation, with only two elements, captures some of the counterintuitive features of the shapes we observe in the real physical system, particularly the sharp peaks on the skirt. This doesn't mean that other elements like gravity aren't there and aren't playing important roles, but they're not necessary for certain features to arise in the system. One ingredient that is important, however, is that the body isn't a rigid rotator. There's a steadily rotating shape, but the material of the skirt flows along this shape, and you can see this in any video of the process. A consequence of this is that the material experiences a type of inertial force called a Coriolis force, much in the same way that objects or wind moving on the rotating earth experience a Coriolis force. And this force allows the formation of multiple peaks like those we see on the real skirts. While the origin of the research might seem whimsical or trivial, we now understand a bit more about the physics and the flows on flexible objects, and this is knowledge we can apply in many other physical contexts.
That was James Hanna of Virginia Tech. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.